You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, November 4th, 2021. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Margaret Macmillan, professor of history at University of Toronto and author of War, How Conflict Shaped Us. Meanwhile, the Biden administration has set a January 4th deadline for its vaccine mandate that isn't really a mandate. All businesses with 100 or more employees will either need to get the shot for their workers, ensure that they do, or have them undergo weekly testing. And this comes as the first shots for children ages 5 to 11 have been administered throughout the U.S. An independent, I say that in quotes, Pentagon review of the Pentagon finds that despite video surveillance identifying a child 2 minutes before launching their strike in Kabul, which ended up killing 10 civilians and 7 children, the Pentagon doesn't feel disciplinary actions necessary. So, what a relief. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy has officially defeated Republican challenger Jack Cittarelli in a race that ended up being pretty close. Murphy is the first incumbent Democratic governor to win re-election in New Jersey since 1977. It's shocking to me. It's a blue state. New York City's mayor-elect Eric Adams has said that he will revisit Bill de Blasio's vaccine mandates for city workers after police and firefighter unions raised hell, even though only a handful of them resigned. Adams is a former cop himself.
How about cops? If you stop killing people, you don't have to get vaccinated.
Deal! Lisa Murkowski was the lone Republican senator to vote in favor of opening debate on the John Lewis Voting Rights Act yesterday, which would reinstate part of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It is the second time a voting rights bill has been killed by the filibuster in 2 weeks. And lastly, the Biden administration has rejected a proposal for monetary compensation for the families separated at the border. What he's saying, nothing will fundamentally change. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is Thursday, so Sam is out, but we have a great show for you today. The continued infrastructure fight is marching along. The water is a bit muddy right now on what's going to be in the final package and what won't be in the final package, but we will get to that in a bit because Manchin is, of course, predictably making the media rounds. It is quite interesting how someone like Kyrsten Sinema, she doesn't feel like her negotiation should be tainted by the public discourse, so she does it in private. But mostly for Manchin, this is a vehicle for attention, since his agenda is a bit different than her. And he gets that in spades on Fox News, on cable news, on MSNBC, wherever it is, Manchin will be there, and we'll have some of those clips for you. But somebody who has not been in the spotlight whatsoever at all, really, throughout the first year of this Biden presidency and in the infrastructure fight, is the Vice President, Kamala Harris, once deemed the rising star of the Democratic Party by the powers that be, and that was evidenced by the fact that Biden handpicked her to be the VP when there were a lot of other choices. Even, you know, he expressed desire to have a woman of color as his vice president. There were a lot of other, even more establishment picks that might have been a bit more effective than Kamala Harris, because she's done nothing.
Yeah, she's never shown any sort of like purchase with voters at a wide scale.
Never. She had a short tenure in the Senate, and you hear also rumblings of a lot of dysfunction in her own camp. So if she thinks that she's going to be a viable presidential candidate in 2024 or 2028, wow, that sounds so far away, I have significant concerns, because her instincts are terrible. And she was asked in a rare media appearance about the results of the elections on Tuesday, and this is what she had to say.
Are there messages for the Democratic Party heading into next year's elections based on what you saw in New Jersey and Virginia?
I'm going to leave that to the pundits, but I will say this. We had great wins, as well as obviously what we talked about in Virginia, and I celebrate those. We have Eric Adams in New York. In Ohio, we had with Ms. Brown, Chantel Brown, a great win and a great, I think, what will be a great addition to the United States Congress. So, as I said, I supported Terry McAuliffe. But I congratulate Mr. Youngkin, and we will keep doing what we need to do. And on the issue, again, of voting rights, we're going to keep fighting.
Okay. So the two races that she listed there were Eric Adams in New York, you know, the purple New York, and Chantel Brown, which was the race that Nina Turner ended up losing in the primary in deep, deep blue Cleveland. These would be the exact races they would be writing off if Nina Turner had won that race and if a progressive had won, in the way that they're writing off Michelle Wu being, not necessarily, but some are, or in the way that they wrote off Ilhan Omar, in the way that they wrote off Rashida Tlaib, in the way that they wrote off Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, dense blue areas that progressives are winning in, now they're deeming them as significant wins for the Democratic Party. And then she talks about how they're going to keep pushing on voting rights.
Keep fighting.
There's no fight to be had unless you reform or eliminate the filibuster. So again, we're having this circular conversation. We're having the same conversation over and over again. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe when she was on the stump for Terry McAuliffe, she was presenting a compelling case for why Democrats should be supported in the upcoming elections. Here's just a snippet of her campaigning for him.
I tell everybody you know to vote tomorrow. Nothing like saying, you want to meet me tomorrow? What you doing tomorrow? You got any plans tomorrow? Tomorrow's a good day. It's going to be a good day. But the point is,
what I mean?
It's like she's trying out catchphrases. Like, it's like she's talking to babies.
There's nothing like saying, you want to meet me tomorrow?
And the crowd's like, huh, yeah, that's relatable. What?
Want to meet me tomorrow down by the corner store?
You know what would be nice to
cigarettes?
Say? You know what would be nice to have told those voters? Hey, remember how I told the parliamentarian to stuff it when the parliamentarian stood between you and a $15 minimum wage? That would be actually some content to fill out the insistence. Hey, that tomorrow's right around the corner.
Tomorrow's
like,
the day.
What are we talking about?
Tomorrow's the day that comes right after today, man. What kind of, I mean, she's also like, she's doing a bit of like a dazed and confused thing there. Not necessarily sure
McConaughey?
Where she's going with it. Yeah, she's like dusting off the McConaughey impression on the stump for Terry McAuliffe. I mean, really painful and really awkward. It was a bit of a please clap moment for her. And so the point of playing these clips is to show that the Democrats are pretty much without a paddle right now. And they don't know where to turn.
Because they're allowing Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin to just throw their paddles into the river.
Yeah, because the Kamala Harris and Joe Biden could have gotten out ahead of this, and they could have made the case and stuck their necks out for the policy proposals that they purport to support. The issue is that they favor Senate process over policy, but that's not popular to say, obviously. So they have to kind of just massage the truth in this area. And if they had believed in their principles and they had decided that these policies were so important, universal pre-K, the expansion of Medicare, although universal pre-K seems to remain in the package, the one thing that allows for parents to go back to work, as Matt has pointed out for us. But all of these proposals, free community college, the climate initiatives, because the enforcement provisions are entirely stripped out of that, if they had stuck their neck out a little bit more, we wouldn't be in the situation that we're in right now.
We wouldn't have to be talking about how great it is, like, just generically that tomorrow exists.
Yeah, right. You would be able to plant your flag with what the Democratic Party stands for. Instead, we have, I'm going to defer to the pundits to analyze the state of the Democratic Party, which, if Biden passed away tomorrow, I would be the leader of. Just think about that for a sec. And also, I'm going to dust off my dazed and confused workshop, maybe some improv classes on the stump for Terry McAuliffe. It's dark stuff in the Democratic Party right now. And it's not to say that I think the Virginia election was indicative of too much larger. I mean, I do think that the critical race theory push is going to be something that the Republicans focus on, but it's just their new culture war stuff.
Yeah, it's the same crap as always.
It is. And as Sam pointed out yesterday, the results in Virginia's gubernatorial elections ping pong back and forth. But the lack of confidence I feel in the ability of people like Biden and Kamala Harris to effectively dig the Democrats out of this hole in time for this time next year, it's pretty much sub-zero. So that's that. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. We will hear from Sam on one of our sponsors. And when we come back, we will be joined by Margaret MacMillan, professor of history at University of Toronto and author of War, How Conflict Shaped Us, and we will be talking about war and much more after this.
Thank you, Emma. Hey, today's sponsor is BetterHelp Online Counseling. They're giving our audience 10% off their first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. BetterHelp gives you access to your own fully licensed and accredited therapist via phone, chat, or video. Now, sure, you're aware if you've attempted to go see a therapist, therapists elsewhere have long wait lists. Sometimes it can take you weeks. Sometimes it can take you months before they can see you. But when you sign up with BetterHelp, they match you with a therapist based on your specific needs, and you'll be communicating with them in less than 24 hours. A lot of people found telemedicine to be very helpful, particularly therapy during COVID. And I suspect there's a lot of folks who are just going to stick with that. I found it much more convenient. Obviously, a lot of stress coming out of a pandemic, a lot of stress during a pandemic, a lot of stress when there's not a pandemic. Therapy has been extremely helpful for me. It's always helpful to speak to someone. And once BetterHelp connects you with a therapist, if you find that it's not a good fit, you can switch to a new one at any time for any reason with no additional charge. They have thousands of licensed therapists from all over the country, so they have therapists with specialties that may not even be available in your area. BetterHelp also tends to be more affordable than therapists that you'd find through traditional means. You don't have to have insurance to use BetterHelp, and they have financial aid options for those who qualify. BetterHelp is giving everyone in our audience 10% off your first month when you go to betterhelp.com/majority report. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P, betterhelp.com/majority report. You can find the URL in the description of this video or podcast, and check it out.
We are back. And we are joined now by Margaret MacMillan, professor of history at University of Toronto and author of War, How Conflict Shaped Us. Margaret, thank you so much for your time today and joining us on this program.
Pleasure to be here.
Well, I'm excited to talk to you because, I mean, your book is ambitious in scope, and it really, I mean, we spend so much time sanitizing, commemorating and mythologizing war that analoging it, I mean, and studying its actual history and how it moves with and shapes our history, it almost takes a back seat. Why did you find that was the case in writing your book here?
I think we think about war, as you say, something mythological. We think about the great moments. We think about the great disasters. And I think what we need to do is also think about it as a very constant force, unfortunately, in human history. which has shaped our societies, our ideas, our worlds, our cultures. And so I think it's one of those great forces like geography or climate or economics. And I think we need to take it into account because it's played such an important part in human history.
And do you think that part of the reason that it's not taken into account is because when grappling with the violence of it, one has to actually think about the violence?
We have to confront that it's violent. Yeah. And I think we don't like to. And I think a lot of us live in very peaceable societies where we disapprove rightly of violence. And so there's a fear that if we study war too much, we might get enamored of it and enamored of and begin to love violence. And of course, war is about violence, but it's about much more. It's about organizing. It's an enormously organized institution. When you think of the money, the organization, the human beings, the material you need, it's helped to build our bureaucracies and our strong central governments.
Right. I mean, one of the things that you wrote about, which I thought was like really interesting, and we're a leftist show, so we're often speaking about war, and it's we appreciate anti-war movements, but you also see how war sometimes elevates labor and elevates wages because the demand is so necessary and the organization of society is so needed in a wartime effort. Particularly, I think about, of course, World War II and the way the United States responded and women entering the workforce, for example.
I think it's one of the paradoxes, and there are many paradoxes about war. I mean, we're simultaneously attracted and repelled by it. But the great paradox is that it can sometimes bring beneficial results. And we wouldn't choose to do it that way. And we should be doing it in other ways. But sometimes a great catastrophe makes us treat our less fortunate members of society better. It helps to level the playing field between the very rich and the poor. It makes for more equal societies. It's helped to promote war. The Second World War, as you said, helped to promote women's rights. It's a bit like the COVID pandemic. It has brought about great changes in society, which may in the end be beneficial for us, but we wouldn't do it in that way if we could do it some other way.
And I mean, maybe this is a bit philosophical, but like, why are we unable to galvanize our society without these great bloody and horrific catastrophes?
I don't know. I guess it's partly human nature. You know, if things are going along fairly smoothly, we get on with our lives and we think about our lives, and that's as it should be. But sometimes we need to think, and politicians need to think, in the long future. We need to think what's going to happen in the next 10 years, the next 20 years. I mean, I think climate change is another example of this. You know, we are going to have to start thinking collectively as a human species about how we deal with climate change. And we're not very good at thinking out ahead, especially, as I say, if times are going fairly well.
Right. I guess we can back up then and talk about this and historicize war as a concept. We can go as far back in the Roman Empire, which you write about, and then also, I guess, take it up to the French Revolution in order to historicize it, and then we can modernize our conversation. But let's back up then to the Roman Empire and the way that it approached war.
Yeah. And I think you've touched on something very important, is that is that different societies fight different sorts of war because they're different and their goals are different and the structure of their societies is different. So in Roman society, the Romans were very, very efficient at fighting, but only those who were free men fought. Slaves didn't fight, and there were a great many slaves in the Roman Empire. And it was considered an honorable calling, and it was something that young men were expected often to do. They were expected to do military service. What happened with the French Revolution was that we got a very different notion of what it meant to belong to a society and belong to a state. And that was we became citizens. The Romans, of course, were citizens too if they were free, but we forgot about that for a long time. But with the French Revolution, we remembered again that people were citizens, men, of course, in those days it was men, but it eventually became women too. And when you're a citizen, you have an obligation to defend your state because it belongs to you. And so we get a very new relationship, I think, developing as a result of the French Revolution and other changes between people and their governments.
Does that connect the concept of citizenry to nationalism? Because, I mean, in the United States, constantly, it's only taxpaying citizens, taxpayers. The history of the concept of taxpaying is a separate, you know, racialized history in the U.S. But even, I mean, when you're dividing up citizens versus non-citizens, it creates tribal instincts that might cause new dynamics with war.
Unfortunately, I think citizenship does, but not always, but it can go along with a sort of nationalism, often an ethnic nationalism, where we all belong to the same family because we speak the same language or have the same religion. And the United States, as a great country with many different religions and many different ethnicities within it, I think has avoided some of that nationalism. But certainly you do get a connection between nationalism and war. I mean, if you think your nation is the best one, or if you think it's threatened, then you are going to want to defend it and you're going to want to fight for it. And so the connection between nationalism and war is often quite a close one.
And what were some of the differences that you were able to trace with, say, you know, traditional Western or European approaches to war? I mean, I would imagine colonialism plays a significant role. But even prior to that, the way even European nomadic people fought, or settled societies in Europe versus, say, other continents throughout the globe.
Well, you fight with what you have. And if you have weapons that aren't very good or very strong, like bronze weapons, you're careful about how you use them because you know they can break in your hands. And once you get stronger iron weapons, then you can be a bit more daring. And the horse makes a huge difference because men on horseback, and again, it was mainly men, can sweep over and attack people on the ground. They're much more mobile. And so depending on what's available, that affects how you fight. But you had then, of course, what societies do is learn how to respond to that. And so eventually the horse was dealt with by foot soldiers who stood firm, and the development of better arrows, for example, and bows that could fire further away. And eventually, of course, the development of gunpowder. So whatever is available to society will affect the way it fights. But so too will the nature of societies. If you have a very hierarchical society where only the aristocrats at the top, for example, are able to own property and do certain things, they will tend to have those people fight as well. They don't want ordinary people fighting because they might learn how to use it against their own rulers.
Right. And so I guess we can talk a little bit about we can move to the French Revolution, where I think there's a lot of the pivot points that you point to. How did things shift then? Because my understanding, and from what I've read, monarchs in Europe before that time tended to rely on a hodgepodge of fighters, often mercenaries, and then this really shifted after the French Revolution in Europe. Tell us a little bit about that shift and why that cemented certain institutions.
Sure. Well, in Europe before the French Revolution, and the American Revolution is very important here as well because it's an example and a lot of Europeans pay attention to it. But in the 18th century and before, the people who were the officers tended to come from the upper classes because that was just expected what you did if you were a young man from the upper classes. And otherwise, you used as ordinary soldiers people you didn't want for anything else. And so you wouldn't take a good farmer and make him into a soldier because that person would be much better off farming and producing food for everyone else. In England, in the 18th century, if you were sent to jail, if you were going to be executed, for example, you were often given a choice of going to jail or being executed or joining the army, which tells you something about the sort of treatment and the expectations of ordinary soldiers. But the American Revolution and the French Revolution set in motion this idea that people are not subjects, they're citizens. In other words, they have a share in their own government, they help to choose their own government, and correspondingly they want to try and defend it. And the other thing that happened in the 19th century was the Industrial Revolution, which may have started in Europe, but rapidly spread around the world. And it made it possible to move people much larger numbers using things like railways and steamships, and then eventually the internal combustion engine and airplanes. And it made it possible to produce huge amounts of weapons, huge amounts of uniforms, made it possible to have much bigger wars. And so you had motivation for war increasing with I think, nationalism and this notion that we're citizens and have to defend our own government and our own society. It's also possible to have much bigger wars, which is why the First and Second World Wars were so massive in scale.
And how did that correspond with Napoleon's rise in particular?
Napoleon was just at the beginning of this change, and he benefited from the newly awakened sense of French nationalism, and his soldiers felt they were fighting for a cause. They felt they were fighting for France, for liberty, equality, and fraternity. And they also saw themselves as missionaries. They were going to spread these ideas around Europe. And when they began to spread them, of course, they created opposition. And people said, well, actually, we're not French, but we have our own views. And so in a funny way, the French, by wanting to spread their ideas, actually increased nationalism among other people, which was often turned on them. But Napoleon was still fighting in the old way. He was in charge before modern technology had begun to make a huge difference. And so his soldiers had to march. And one of his real problems always was feeding them and keeping them supplied, which is why when he invaded Russia in 1812 with a massive army, he couldn't feed that army. And a lot of the soldiers who went with Napoleon to Russia died of starvation, not because the Russians killed them, although, of course, a lot of them were killed in fighting, too. So if Napoleon had commanded modern armies, say, in the 20th century, he would have been, I think, a very formidable commander indeed.
So kind of ahead of his time in that era. I mean, not to laud it, of course, but just in looking at it in a dispassionate way. And then probably spurring a lot of technological innovations with war as his influence crept across Europe and wars of nationalism became a bit more normalized.
Yeah, well, war has always spurred technological innovation, because if you can get an edge on the enemy with a better weapon, with, say, a better type of metal or a stronger bow that can fire further, or, of course, guns that are more efficient and fire further, then you have a real advantage. And so often countries have invested in technology for war, and in wartime that has often sped up. I mean, I think the development of airplanes, for example, and then the development of the jet engine was very much speeded up. It's probably going to happen anyway, but very much speeded up by war. And often governments and societies will spend money in war on investments in technology and science, which they wouldn't spend in peacetime. You know, the example I often use is penicillin, which has saved literally millions of lives since it first began to be put into production. It was discovered how to make it at the end of the 1920s, but everyone thought it was too expensive. When the Second World War came, suddenly it wasn't too expensive. And I think we're seeing the same thing with the reaction to the COVID pandemic. What would have been too expensive before the pandemic started, the research, the production of the vaccines,
right,
became important.
Yes. And I mean, I guess to stay with Europe in that time, I mean, if we're moving to the UK, the East India Company, the usage of militarism in order to maintain global capitalism. How did that fit into war as influencing and spurring certain innovations and certain social structures?
Well, imperialism and colonialism, the settlement of peoples from Europe and elsewhere around the world, were really enabled by the dominance that European societies, and that includes, in fact, the United States, which very much benefited from this, the dominance they had in technology. And it wasn't a dominance that was going to last for long. It was a very brief period. I mean, before the beginning of the 19th century, China was probably as strong or stronger than most European countries. Japan was probably as strong or stronger. The Ottoman Empire was strong or stronger. But what happened in the course of the 19th century was that European countries, Western countries, developed this technological edge. And so they had better weapons when they went out to deal with the sorts of people they were trying to take over. It was a very, very unfair battle, very unfair advantage. And eventually, of course, what was going to happen is knowledge of the technology and ways of using it was going to spread. But it certainly is true that a lot of Western empires, and the expansion of the United States as well, were a result of war or depended on the war-making capacity of the powers that were carrying out this expansion.
And we've modernized that technological innovation in the form of what we colloquially call the military-industrial complex. Because, I mean, still, military technologies in the United States will ramp up, even though the money is constantly there, but will ramp up, and those industries will accumulate a lot of capital and growth during times of war.
Yeah, and it's something that President Eisenhower warned about in one of his last speeches. You know, he said it can be dangerous. And I think what he was implying was every country needs to defend itself and should have defense industries, but it can be dangerous if the defense industries are too powerful and influence government in things like procurement. I mean, sometimes you get very effective lobbyists who say to governments, you must have this latest airplane or this latest weapon. Governments may not need it. And I think it's dangerous because sometimes huge amounts of money are spent on things which may not necessarily be in the best interest of the country. So I think Eisenhower was right there, that you have to really look critically at what it is you're trying to do and what sort of weapons you need, and not let the money, not let those be determined by the companies that are going to make money out of it. On the other hand, the investment in military things has often had big benefits for civilian society. I mean, a lot of the early investment which made the internet possible was done for military reasons, defense reasons, but of course it helped to spawn Silicon Valley and the world in which we now live.
And then Silicon Valley has become in and of itself its own danger, but I mean, I think that's sometimes just the nature of capitalism, and there's a way too that the this can feed upon itself. If the money-making machine becomes so lucrative, then wartime can be more tantalizing for governments when there's an understanding that money can be had. Especially, I mean, we see this. I thought the Iraq War was a significant example of that.
And I don't think governments go to war because they think they've got all this weaponry. I mean, I've never felt that an arms race or the development of arms creates war. But if you believe that you have tremendous power and you believe you have an edge over all your opponents, you tend to think you can sort everything out. And I think one of the traps that the British fell into when they had their big empire, and I think the Americans perhaps have fallen into it a bit as well, certainly in Iraq, was thinking that because our power is so overwhelming, everyone else is going to recognize it. You know, these people will be fighting with much inferior weapons to ours. Same thing is true in Afghanistan. I mean, the weapons, for the most part, that the Taliban and the other groups in Afghanistan are using are not terribly sophisticated, but they're using them very skillfully, and they know the country, and they can hide in it. And so I think the danger for advanced technological societies is to think technology can do everything. And I think we're realizing it can do an awful lot, but it can't do everything.
We are covering today just the fact that the Kabul drone strike executed by the Biden administration was, you know, the technology so precise, you're able to locate the exact terrorists at this exact point. And of course, the Pentagon is admitting that 10 civilians were killed, including 7 children. And that's, you know, when you fall back on technology and you fetishize it to a way, then you fall into these traps.
Yes. And I think technology, you know, I'm always worried when people say we can pinpoint exactly where we're going to drop a bomb or use a drone, because one of the things we know for sure that happen in war is mistakes and accidents, and things don't always turn out the way you expect them to. And I think to rely too much on technology, I mean, of course you have to rely on technology in war, that's part of war making, but to rely on it to solve all your problems and to assume that it's always going to work correctly, I think is a big step, and I think you should really, really be careful.
So I wanted to back up a little bit because, you know, we were talking about the 1800s, we were talking about Napoleon in this time period, and the Civil War was the bloodiest war in the United States history. I mean, what did that do for U.S. society and how it categorized it, besides the obvious divisions between North and South? But in terms of the innovation and the tech that you describe, especially relative to the way society became organized in regards to Native Americans and indigenous people?
Well, I think what the Civil War did is show just how important railways were and how important it was to have a strong industrial base. And one of the things that really told in favor of the North was that they had an advantage in both those areas. And the South, which had probably, I mean, many will disagree with them, but I think the South probably had better generals. Certainly in Robert E. Lee, they had an amazing general, but they didn't have that base and they didn't have the capacity to move their troops around in the same way. And I don't need to tell you or any Americans about the divisions that the Civil War has left in American society. I mean, you're still arguing about it, and I suspect you'll go on arguing about it. But what the Civil War did, I think, in terms of American attitudes was, I think it enhanced the value of military force, that military force could be used to settle a lot of things. And of course, after the Civil War was over, there was this tremendous expansion westwards, which brought the rest of the continental United States under the into the American Federation. And that was an expansion that was marked by wars, often very violent wars, and by a great deal of violence. A number of cases, the indigenous Americans fought back. I mean, they had acquired by this point weapons which they're able to use, and they also had some very good military commanders, but they were simply overwhelmed by a much larger society that kept on pressing into their lands.
Right. I was also fascinated a little as well by some of the ways in which popular armies shape societies in this time period that you wrote about that I would never have thought of, including instilling values of, I guess, kind of militarism or even racism or misogynistic attitudes in young men in some of these societies because of the way that we chose to construct armies going forward.
Well, sometimes it's not even a choice. Sometimes it's just something that happens. It's to do with the nature of society. And you had certainly in Europe before the First World War. I think you had it less in the U.S., but even kind of, certainly in North America and Canada, my own country, in the U.S., in this period, so towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th, you did get in societies an admiration for the military, a feeling that the military was somehow nobler and better than the rest of us. They were the ones, after all, who prepared to sacrifice their lives and defend the rest of us. And it's an, you know, you understand that admiration, but it's dangerous when it gets to the point that we, if when people say we mustn't question the military because they are the key part of the nation. And that certainly happened in Germany and a few other countries. And that was dangerous because it let the military think they could make up their own minds and they didn't have to pay attention to the civilians. But what also was happening, and this was part of the militarism, was that a number of societies, military values, as you pointed out, were filtering out into society. You know, when I look at pictures of school classes in Europe, particularly before the First World War, school children are wearing uniforms. You know, they all look like little soldiers or little sailors. And that, I think, is an indication of the way in which military values were admired. Even things like the Boy Scouts were set up initially to instill military values, discipline, serving your country and so on, learning how to read maps, learning how to read compasses. They were set up to make the boys and later on the girls who joined them good little soldiers, or in the case of the girls, good nurses, good supports for wars. So I think that can be a bad thing when societies get infiltrated, if you like, with too many military values. It's not that they're bad values, but there are other values that are important too.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And we've talked about this on the show too, specifically in the Donald Trump era when he was so chaotic and crazy. And there were some people who were, you know, looking to military leadership or saying, oh, look at this military leader critiquing Donald Trump. They are above the perils and the pitfalls of the elected representatives who are crazy or whatever. And while we were in agreement about Trump's threats, that tendency is troubling because you can see it internationally. That's how military leadership ends up resulting in coups.
Well, I think it's interesting. In the United States, I believe that polls show that the military are among the most admired, perhaps the most admired people in American society. Politicians come way down, and I hate to tell you, journalists don't come much higher. As far as I know in the polls, and I'm not sure academics are any better, so I can't take any pleasure in that. And I can understand why people admire the military, but I agree with you that it shouldn't be something that society sort of resort to. At least we've got a good military. I think we need to deal with all our problems, and we can't count on the military to solve them. And I thought what was worrying in the Trump period was the way in which he tried to involve the military in his own political machinations. I mean, that famous march to the church in Washington, where he dragged the chief of the joint staff, the joint chief of staff, with him. Now, that, I think, was bad for the military, and I think a lot of military actually came to think so. And I think it was also, you know, it's not a good sign when you get former military, a lot of them very distinguished and a very high rank, doing what the military usually don't do and expressing their worry about the government. Not a good sign. I can understand why they're worried, and I think they were right to express it, but you don't want that happening in a society.
I'm wondering if we could just take a quick turn to talk a little bit about the history of the anti-war movement relative to the way that modern warfare came to be. In your research, what did you find about the burgeoning anti-war movement, when it ebbed and when it flowed, and how that fit into some of the different wars throughout history?
I think we've always had anti-war movements. I mean, they've taken different forms in different eras and different societies. But I think in many cultures around the world, there've always been those who said war is a very wasteful and, in the end, very dangerous way of settling our disputes. There must be other ways of doing it. You know, there's a strong tradition in traditional Chinese society, for example, that statesmanship and dealing with those who might be your enemies is much the better way than making war on them. And I think this is something that most societies have grappled with. Also, how do you try and protect the innocent? How do you try and protect the civilians who really have no part in war, yet get caught up in it? Or how do you protect those who are made prisoner? I mean, these are things that societies have thought about for a very long time. Or how do you try and get rid of war altogether? I mean, the ancient Greeks had a practice of not fighting on certain religious holidays, not fighting during the Olympics. The medieval church in Europe tried to bring in something similar where it said there should be no fighting on days like Christmas or Easter. And so we've had repeated attempts trying to limit war and actually trying to get rid of it. I think often anti-war movements tend to grow in strength just after a war, or when there's been a war scare. And so during the Cold War, for example, you know, after the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think we all began to think we really need to, you know, get engaged and do something about this because we might all be blown sky high. And so I think how strongly we feel about trying to deal with war depends very much on our societies, but it depends on what we've just gone through. I mean, after the First World War, anti-war movements were very strong, and there was a tremendous support for the League of Nations, which was meant to make war impossible. And same thing after the Second World War.
Right. And of course, we had maybe the United States at the height of its power coming out of the Second World War and its air of legitimacy. And then we moved to Vietnam. And then, of course, the Gulf War and the Iraq War, which three wars that, I mean, are indefensible in my opinion. And then, of course, I think we're at a very precarious state for the American empire precisely because of those wars.
Well, one of the things about being a great power is you have to persuade other people you're a great power. You know, you can do counting. You can count how many guns you have and how many aircraft you have and how many ships you have and so on. But there is also this sort of rather difficult thing to measure, and that is credibility and how much are other people going to believe in you. Now, I don't think everything the United States did since the end of the Second World War contributed to a perception of the United States as weak. I mean, the United States fought very successfully in Korea, and I think that is something that, you know, Americans can remember. And in Vietnam, in a curious way, I would argue, as others have done, that the United States actually won the war on the ground, but that wasn't the point. It lost it in public opinion. And in the end, Americans at home said, you know, what is this about? And it's not worth fighting. And so I think the United States still has credibility as a military power, but you're absolutely right that the experience, not the first Gulf War, I mean, when Saddam Hussein was evicted from Kuwait, I mean, that was, I think, a very striking American victory and one which the Americans wisely, in my view, stopped when they had achieved their goal of getting Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. They didn't try and overthrow his regime. The second intervention, of course, the invasion and occupation of Iraq at the beginning of the 2000s, I think did end badly. And I think left a lot of Americans wondering what they had been there for. And Iraq doesn't seem to be any better off. And indeed, it's worse off than it perhaps it was when the Americans intervened. And I think the same thing is true of Afghanistan. But that doesn't mean that the United States is fatally weakened. It remains a very big military power. And I think what will be important in the next years is what the United States and its military and its political leaders and its people learn from the Iraq invasion and occupation, learn from Afghanistan, and how they use their very considerable power. I mean, I think it's going to be a time, I hope, of considerable sort of studying and reflection for Americans. What can we learn from this, and what do we do as we look into the future?
Well, because I think when we're framing, you know, who won and who didn't, we're like the context of, say, if we're talking about Vietnam, the My Lai Massacre, or the way that children are inextricably disfigured, and there are all of these horrors that are associated with it. In the Gulf War, we destroyed nearly 90% of Iraq's water infrastructure. Like, I think some of that context of warfare is lost when we're looking at it from a 30,000-foot view.
I think that can be dangerous. And I think, you know, Americans have lost their lives in Afghanistan and Iraq. But we need to remember that far more Iraqis and Afghanis have been killed in the years of fighting there. And I think, you know, we have to, as societies, and, you know, Canada was not involved in the invasion and occupation of Iraq, but we were involved in Afghanistan. We have to, as societies, look at what we did there. I think we have to face what went wrong, what we might have done differently. I agree with you that we have to understand the costs of the war and not turn our backs on them. I mean, the temptation always, particularly, I think, after war ends, is just to get on with life and forget about it and not talk about it very much. And I notice even now the coverage of what's going on in Afghanistan and Iraq is much, much less than it would have been, you know, immediately after the troops were pulled out.
Well, I mean, it was curious, too, how we talked about it at length. The coverage of our Afghanistan withdrawal was so histrionic and, what are we doing, as opposed to the fuller context of the 19 years previously in which the United States was not able to gain footing in Afghanistan in any meaningful way.
Well, there'll be many people, it's already started, of course, looking at what went right and what went wrong in Afghanistan. And one argument, which I think, needs to be examined, is if the NATO allies, led, of course, by the United States, which was the largest contributor in Afghanistan, if the NATO allies had resolved to put into Afghanistan some of the resources that were later put elsewhere. I mean, the United States did put troops into Afghanistan, did put resources into Afghanistan, but it was almost immediately distracted by the invasion and occupation of Iraq. It is possible that things might have turned out differently in Afghanistan, that if there had been a sustained nation-building effort, as it was hit and miss, the goals kept changing. I remember hearing a Canadian diplomat talk, and he listed about 10 different goals of why Canada was in Afghanistan, and they kept changing. And they started out to get rid of the Taliban and deal with al-Qaeda, and then it became building an infrastructure, then it became building a modern economy, then it became women's rights, all of which were good aims. But it seems to me there was really lack of any clarity among those who were responsible for Afghanistan, the governments back home, what it is we were doing there and what sort of resources we'd need. And I think we need to look at that, because if we get involved, we from the West or powerful countries get involved again in countries with failing states or states that collapse, then we really need to know what we're doing.
Lastly, I just wanted to touch on the concept of getting good at war as society evolves and how we've kind of practiced it. And now, I don't know if it's possible to get good at war, but I mean, that's kind of seemed to be the aim throughout history. We take steps and we try to innovate and make things cleaner. But as I mentioned with the example earlier, it's impossible to do so. So, I guess to wrap things up, talk a little bit about that idea.
War is very organized, and I think in many societies we've become better at it as we've become more organized. And often there's an argument, actually, that the more you make war, the more organized you get as a society. It's very difficult to know which comes first, chicken or egg. But I think when you look at how organized modern armies are compared, say, to armies in the past, the sheer amount of organizational detail and planning that has to go on, I think we have become good at it. But what always matters is whether or not a people or a nation want to fight. And I think what's really interesting is how you've had real shifts over time. The Swedish soldiers and Swedish armies used to be the terror of Europe up until the end of the 18th century. And now think of Sweden today. It's seen as a country which sponsors peace and sponsors peace initiatives. And that's very true. Germany, which was one of the most militaristic countries in Europe before 1945, it's hard today to imagine Germany starting a world war again. It's just become a very different society. And so I think we change. And so making war, we may get the organizational side better, but we may not want to do it. And I think that in a way is a good thing, except we always run into the problem of what do we do if someone attacks us and when we have to defend ourselves. And then we may find ourselves changing our attitudes towards war. Very difficult to predict, I think, how we will react until it actually happens.
Margaret McMillan, professor of history at University of Toronto and professor emeritus, I should say, at Oxford University as well, author of War, How Conflict Shaped Us. Margaret, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back and wrap up the first hour of this program. We are back. We are back. COP26 is ongoing, and we have covered on this program about how nations like Costa Rica and other nations that don't have necessarily the prowess of the United States, the capital,
the responsibility for the problem they're meant to be solving.
Exactly. The being the number one contributors, the United States should be speaking a lot at COP26 about themselves and critiquing our own contributions to this problem. But countries that are going to be the most affected by the climate catastrophes that are coming around the bend are given short shrift at events like this. So they must be getting bumped for people who are real speakers, right? Really on the front lines of what climate change is doing to our world. Just kidding. I bring you Jeff Bezos, who has a very benevolent idea for how he and Amazon is going to be just so, so kind to the world and help out with climate change. Thank you. Thank you, Jeffrey.
That's why last month in New York, 9 philanthropic organizations announced an additional $5 billion to support the goal of 30 by 30. To protect 30% of all land and sea by 2030.
Why is it all like Forbes titles? Like 30 by 30? Like I thought that was the ESPN thing.
Yeah, well, it's a 30 for 30, but now it's 30 by 30. It's a way for like his PR people who met with him before to say, this will be really snappy and it'll give Amazon some great PR.
30% of all land and sea by 2030. I was honored to be a part of this with a $1 billion pledge from the Bezos Earth Fund. And today, I'm pleased to announce a $2 billion pledge allocated directly to restoring nature and transforming food systems.
I'll do it.
This is part of the Bezos Earth Fund's $10 billion commitment to fight climate change, enhance nature, and advance environmental justice and economic opportunity. Together, this $3 billion in pledges will drive a new threefold nature.
Sorry, I just need to back this up to the part where he said we're going to advance nature.
Yeah, there's going to be exponential growth in nature, and the shareholders are going to be thrilled. My favorite part was when he said transforming earth systems. Yeah. Right? Like, that's what he said?
I'm glad we gave you the authority to do that. Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you so much. And thank you for using all of your just corporate gobbledygook, and it's gobbledygook coming out of my mouth, too, and just copy-pasting climate terms into it.
Food systems.
Food systems, not earth systems.
A $2 billion pledge allocated directly to restoring nature and transforming food systems. This is part of the Bezos Earth Fund's $10 billion commitment to fight climate change, enhance nature, advance environmental justice and economic opportunity.
Okay, pause it again. I'm so sorry. How is he going to advance economic opportunity? Oh, by transforming food systems, aka probably selling Amazon food
factory
to
farm
other
monoculture
countries. Awesome.
Enhanced nature is like Bonneville and stuff.
It's like a tidal wave that's going to take out of the United Nations or something.
Opportunity.
Great.
Together, this $3 billion in pledges will drive a new threefold nature agenda for the Bezos Earth Fund, focused simultaneously on conservation, restoration, and food transformation. We must conserve what we still have. We must restore what we've lost, and we must grow what we need to live without degrading the planet for future generations to come.
And we'll do that by enhancing nature. All of the hurricanes I will manufacture to take out my enemies. Zuckerberg, watch out for the earthquake coming to your home. Jeffrey Bezos. Courtesy of him.
So he pledges $2 billion.
I'll solve it.
Well, just to say his Blue Origin space flight, he spent four minutes in orbit. That was $5.5 billion. So,
yeah, it's
priorities of a billionaire.
It's like him buying a candy bar at a convenience store. That's the equivalent for us.
I think it is an absolute insult to everyone's intelligence. And I think just generally, like, it's kind of a human failing that, like, I don't know. Never mind.
You're about to go hard?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll say this. At the very least, stop having guys like Jeff Bezos who are contributing to the problem, because global capitalism is the reason that we are in this situation.
Yeah.
And it exposes the emptiness of these corporate pledges. $2 billion does nothing. You're inviting him to a United Nations conference so that he can have a PR moment and say that he's fighting climate change. Treat corporate pledges, treat billionaire donations, drops in the buckets like they are from the richest man on planet Earth. Treat them as they are. They are ways for these billionaires and corporations to stave off taxation and ensure that the governments that they're speaking to are off their ass and are not going to be asking them for actually substantial money that would affect them long term. They throw these crumbs to these governments, and the leaders are in the audience and they're all there. I'm sure Bezos hobnobbed with Merkel and Biden and whoever the case is, all these other world leaders. So it doesn't do anything to help these causes. In fact, having some guy like Bezos there pretending like he's doing something really hurts the larger cause of climate change, because it obscures what needs to happen of combating climate change.
What needs to happen is these sorts of events need to be disrupted, because these people need to stop being able to just offer pieties to, like, the major media networks of the world as they, you know, spend $5.5 billion to shoot rockets into space. Like, it's disgusting.
It really is. All right, folks, that's all our time for the first half of this program. We are going to head into the fun half. As you may have noticed, Bradley is on vacation this week, so we have said that Matt is gloriously doing, like, three jobs. We need to send the link to Matt and Brandon. So, in the meantime, though, you have your other job, Left Reckoning. Got your other thing going. What's happening over there?
A little bit burnt out, I gotta say. Although last night we had a great job. We did a great job on Left Reckoning.
Did a great job.
We talked to Elke Katsanis, at Equality Alec on Twitter of the Civil Rights Corps. Talked about just the scale of, you know, we talk about police in the context of, like, Democratic campaigns and stuff like that, but it's good to just talk about what a massive apparatus for human caging we have. And when I say massive, an unprecedented in history apparatus of human caging that America has assembled, particularly in the past, like, 50 years. One that, for instance, just one stat that Alec mentions is that we jail black people at a rate of 6 times what apartheid South Africa did. So that is where America is right now. So we have a long, long way to go. We also got his perspective. I think he has a great balanced perspective on progressive DAs. Like, of course, they're very good. It's very good to be less harsh, but also, like, we're going to need to do a lot more and not expect progressive DAs to be the ones that end the carceral system, because it's just fundamentally not going to be able to, like, you can't do it with that office. And we also talk about the complicity of lawyers in jailing all of these human beings, and talk about the pendulum between the dangerous reform consensus that has, like, the Koch brothers helping out the cops with whatever, like, sort of body cameras they need, for instance, acting like it's a big problem, or the moment we're entering now where the papers just lie and say we need more cops because murders are up and that sort of stuff. So that was I really enjoyed the show last night. We also talked about good news of from last night, including independent socialist winning in Minneapolis and Prop A losing in Texas. So not all doom and gloom just because Terry McAuliffe lost. And I'll let Matt Binder in. Right now. Also, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We're going to do a think tank. Oh, and Minneapolis folks, I really want you to check out our talk with GP Jacob about municipal elections in Minneapolis, because I think he has a very grounded, radical perspective on how elections are significant and how they aren't. And it's when the whole sort of, like, we won't get into the minutia of, like, don't vote or do vote. Like, electoralism has a place, but it also, you know, you need to know the limitations.
Right.
Binder, are you there?
Hello, how are you guys doing?
Doing well. How about you?
I'm doing all right.
I think everyone will be shocked to hear that Dave Portnoy has been accused of sexual misconduct.
I just saw that, yeah, by multiple women.
I can't believe it. Just kidding. Matt, I don't mean to be insensitive, but it's like the most obvious thing I've ever seen. Matt, how are you?
I'm good. I guess I'll use this. I guess you're really asking what's going on Doomed.
I am, but also want to know how you're doing.
I'm doing all right. Tonight, well, on Tuesday, I did my first ever, actually, Twitch exclusive stream. Usually I multicast on it, but since I'm demonetized on YouTube and everyone's been telling me, man, just go on Twitch, I decided, hey, why not? So I set up the little affiliate partner program with them, and I did a stream on there, so you can check that out. Also tonight, live on both YouTube and Twitch, youtube.com/MattBinder, twitch.tv/MattBinder. I will be talking to Stephen Monticelli. He is a reporter who was on the ground in Dallas, Texas this past week. Just so happened to be the guy who came across the gaggle of QAnon believers who were waiting for the resurrection of JFK Jr. He's going to bring us all the on-the-ground details that he saw, and whether or not JFK Jr. Ended up showing up at the Rolling Stone show later that night, because that was the rescheduling of his resurrection at a Rolling Stone show that was happening that night. Don't know. Maybe he's back, and we just haven't heard the news yet.
Well, did you also hear, and I'm sure you did because you're ahead of the game on this, that Kayleigh McEnany is the secret daughter of JFK Jr. and his late wife or his late partner who died with him. Just kidding. I'm sorry. They're, of course, still alive. You'd heard that one before?
Yes, I have. Yes. She is one of the Kennedys, apparently, because she looks so much like them. Also, one of the rumors was that JFK himself was going to reveal that he was still alive at the grand old age of like 108, I believe. And he was going to anoint Donald Trump the King of Kings, not just the president of the United States, the King of Kings.
Okay, but I mean, JFK's brains exploded all over the hood of a convertible about 60 years.
Listen. Next thing you're going to tell me is that they couldn't do some visual effects, special effects work to put a man on the moon. Come on here, Matt. Come on.
I mean, we won't get into that one. But
yeah. Where were they hiding that CGI technology back then? Honestly, they could have used it in movies, but it's...
I mean, what's JFK been doing all these years? Probably, I guess, maybe having affairs.
Yeah, just like being a stud. Fucking well, everybody moves.
He's been waiting for Donald Trump to come around and decide to throw his... first of all, he's waiting for Donald Trump to be born, I assume, because he's older than him.
Yeah, right.
And then he was waiting for him to decide to throw his hat in the political ring. And here we are. Now he thinks it's all coming together.
All right, folks. Do we have Brandon?
No, but that might be my fault because I didn't coordinate.
No, it's totally fine. We will head into the fun half then, and Brandon can join us. Everyone, check
Bradley's
out.
Off today.
Bradley's off this week. Yes, so
I figured as much when I didn't get any information.
Yeah. Matt's been doing triple duty here. We will be taking your calls. We will be reading your IMs. 646-257-3920. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY to get 15% 10%. Shit, damn it. Whatever. Some fraction off.
A deal. You get a deal, okay, folks?
You get a very, very great deal. Save all your money. And I actually do need to order some more coffee, so that's a good reminder for me. All right, folks. See you in the fun half.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. Are you guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
You think I might be a Nazi?
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
Do.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh.
Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.